Hello everyone and welcome to this week's edition of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting is Caroline White, our Deputy Editor. A little later in the podcast, you can hear my interview with Ben Willows, the CEO of the UK Sailing Academy, or UKSA as it is better known.
So what kind of training are we talking? Is this where you send your kids to learn to sail, or where you pick up your next crew?
Well, it's both of those things, really. It is they have some great crew, superyacht crew training programs, cadetships, interior crew, hospitality, right up to bridge crew training. So that's really good. And they've got some brand new facilities down there to service the superyacht crew training market. But they also do kids, schools. They have a great outreach program with schools in the UK. So from areas that traditionally don't have access to the water or boats, they get kids from deprived backgrounds and they get them on the water, they get them sailing, which is a really, really cool program. And they also do clubs and things like that. So actually, I'm actually having a meeting with my oldest daughter's head of sport later this very afternoon to talk about trying to get my daughter's school to send a group down there to do some sailing this summer. So they're kind of almost back at full reopening now after obviously being closed for a period due to COVID. But it's great to see the courses up and running again and people at the UKSA. So yeah, Ben's got some great things to say, so do please stick around for that.
So Stu, I've just noticed that you are wearing a sling. Would you like to tell us a little bit more about what's happened?
Yeah. So obviously we're still doing these podcasts via virtually. So Caroline hasn't seen me until now this week. So yeah, I am wearing a sling. I experienced a moment of profound uncoordination the other night playing football, where I'd basically tripped over the ball. Transferred my entire body weight through my elbow as it hit the ground. And as a result, I spent a few hours in A&E getting stitched up, but it's fine. But more excitingly, I'm getting my first COVID jab on Sunday. So Saturday.
Oh, that's right. Fantastic. Your elderliness is finally paying off.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Finally, my age group is eligible. So that'd be good. So I'll have double whammy arm pain from Saturday.
Yeah, you'll be completely incapacitated, I think.
But I'm at the lake and I'm looking forward to it. I just can't wait to get traveling again. And if this jab means that's going to happen sooner, so be it.
Absolutely.
Right, we've got some housekeeping notes for you. Firstly, I'm thrilled to report that we have a new DocQuark website. So our captains and crew title, DocQuark. This has been a very long time coming. It was getting hard to look at a little bit, the old website. So I'm so happy the new one is up and running. And the launch went without a hitch, which is very unusual for a website launch. It's all going very smoothly. Touch wood. I probably shouldn't have said that, but anyway. So do go check it out. And we have some great plans for the site. So keep coming back.
Yeah, there's some really cool stuff on there, even if you're not crew. They've got interviews with various adventurous captains, destinations news, conversations with chefs, and loads of practical stuff too that I have no idea what it means, but I'm sure is very useful to anybody who is professionally working in yachting.
That's right. And we couldn't really get most of the magazine content onto the old website, but now the whole magazine is being elevated to the website, which is fantastic, and there'll be lots of original stuff too going on there. So yeah, definitely go have a look at it. In other Boat International news, we have appointed our first ever business editor. Nick Robinson joins us from the Morning Advertiser, which is a very well-known food and drink title in the UK. So Nick is heading up the new boat business section of boatinternational.com, which will launch in June. And Nick will be responsible basically surfacing some great insights from our market intelligence tool, Boat Pro, and bringing you some really amazing analysis and insights into the superyacht industry.
Boat Pro is just such a useful tool for me and for loads of other people in the industry. And it's really great to see that side of our business expanding. So there's even more to offer people.
Yeah, absolutely. So looking forward to the launch of Boat Business in June. Last but not least, I'm very excited to say we have launched a new social media agency. As a brand, we have really raised our game on social media, and we know very well what it takes to bring your channels to the level that your brand demands. It's just an investment in time and people, and it takes quite a long time. What we can do now is we can work with companies on the same journey. Whether you're a company looking to grow your following with the right audience, or the owner of a charter yacht, for instance, who wants more of the right people engaging with your channels, or simply a company looking for a bit of editorial inspiration, we are now able to help. So if social media is a bugbear for your brand and you want a bit of help, please get in touch via podcast@boatinternationalmedia.com and we will be in touch. How's that for some good plugging?
Excellent plugging. I think you've reached the very limit of the capacity of our listeners for plugging. So well done.
I promise no more plugging. You'll be spared for the rest of the podcast. Caroline, let's get to the news. What are the headlines this week?
Well, a bit of good news to start us off. Fenix, which is the majority shareholder of Perini Navi, has announced plans to save the Italian shipyard from bankruptcy. Reuters reports that they've signed an agreement with a private equity firm called Clisidra and another investor to relaunch the yard. Fenix will inject significant capital and retain a minority stake in Perini Navi, while Clisidra and the unnamed second investor will own majority stakes. The aim is for full production to continue and employment levels to be maintained, which is great news for all of us, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is the most recent instalment in a saga that began when Perini Navi was declared bankrupt by an Italian court in January after it failed to present a final restructuring plan for its debts of 100 million euros. Some major Italian shipyards, including Palumbo, the Italian Sea Group, the Ferretti Group and San Lorenzo, had previously announced plans to acquire the yard and its assets. And the Ferretti Group and San Lorenzo actually joined forces in a venture called Newco to acquire Perini Navi's brands, assets and operations. But it now looks like that won't be necessary.
Yeah, what a saga. Well, I'm thrilled that this isn't the end of Perini Navi by any stretch. And it sounds like production will continue and workers will be kept on, which is brilliant. And we won't lose one of the best known brands in super yachting. And it was interesting seeing that San Lorenzo and the Fritti Group were actually prepared to go into a JV together, effectively, to acquire Perini Navi. This mysterious second investor, I don't know who that is. I guess we'll find out in due course. We'll dig into it a bit more, but it certainly seems like good news.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure there will be more chapters to the saga, so we'll keep you updated when we know more. Next, we have a nice substantial launch with Benetti's 65-metre yacht Zazu. She has an exterior designed by Giorgio Cassetta with a Carinthia blue, which is basically navy blue hull. Zazu was launched at the Benetti yard in Livorno and is due for delivery in time for the summer season. The interior is by Dutch studio Sino Yacht Architecture and Design with a mix of exotic woods, marbles and custom furniture with a soft colour palette. So sounds beautiful. Also has a very cool sounding 20 square meter sun deck with a 5 meter long infinity pool and a gym, a bar, a table for 10 guests, and it can even transform into an open air cinema in the evening. It looks like it was quite a small ceremony at the yard for the launch, but it was nice to see that Benetti wheeled out the confetti machine, which I always enjoy when you go to launches, and they did a kind of confetti explosion in the colours of the Italian flag.
They know how to launch a boat in Italy.
Exactly.
Talking about sun deck pools, the cover boat, no, not the cover boat for our next issue, but one of the boats in the next issue is the Rossi Navi E4. I always thought it was Eve, but actually I learned from reading the feature it was E4. That's the name of the boat. So it's got a sun deck spar pool. It's a 50-meter boat with a significant sun deck spar pool. So I enjoyed reading about how Rossi Navi and the technical managers of that project overcame the issues of weight distribution and things like that, and strengthening of the sun deck. I slipped in another plug for the next issue there, listener. I apologise.
Yeah, stop. stop the plugs now, Stu. I think we've had enough. The final story we've got for you is one for the sailing fans. The first 38-metre Club Swan 125 has been revealed for the first time ahead of hitting the water in June. She's extremely distinctive looking, with a striking yellow and dark grey exterior, and the yard is describing her as the most advanced and radical maxi yacht in sailing history, so big claim. She's built from lightweight materials with carbon fibre, prepreg and a Nomex Corcel core. There's also a single curved foil for lift in varying conditions and also to reduce the drag of the hull and improve the dynamic writing movement. And she holds lots of other technical secrets, I'm sure. She also looks extremely cool, I should say.
Yeah, beast. Absolute beast. I can't wait to see this sailing in various regattas. Really, really competent maxi yacht. So good on Swan. Great to see that being launched. So the data story this week is interesting, isn't it? Because we know, well, the brokerage market continues to be completely on fire. I mean, it is, I don't want to say overheated, but it's certainly very, very hot. About half of all brokerage buyers we know are American. They're an incredibly active yacht buying market, but are they an incredibly active yacht building market? And that is the story this week on the data front. But far be it from me to give away your story, Caroline.
Well, Stu, historically, you're right, because the US was a major builder nation with 1,829 yachts of 24 meter plus built between 1885 and 2020. The average age of those yachts is 31 years, which does suggest that perhaps it's not pumping out quite as many yachts as it once did. If we look at straight numbers delivered, 2000 to 2009 was the strongest period since 1900 with 508 deliveries, but 2010 to 2020 totaled a more modest 301.
So that's a pretty significant decline. So if we're saying the decade after the year 2000 was the strongest period for US boat building since 1900, so 508 deliveries in that period and only 301 in the following decade, so a drop of over 200 boats over 10 years. That's a pretty chunky decline.
So yeah, I mean, I agree it doesn't look great, but 301 is actually the third highest figure for a 10 yearly period in 120 years, so it's not as bad as perhaps it might look.
So looking over the super long term, 301 actually stacks up pretty well.
Absolutely, that's what I'm saying, yeah. Okay. So looking to the future, American projects represent 3.5% of the latest global order book. That's yachts in build or on order around the world. Its world rank is currently number 7 with 29 projects underway, down from a number 4 ranking with 64 projects in 2011. It's not a bad number for one nation, but it suggests that the US building sector is not booming to the great degree that the US brokerage market is.
I think people who aren't intimately involved in the super yacht industry might find those figures surprising, just because the US is such a vast manufacturing nation. You just naturally assume, I suppose, that lots and lots of boats are built in the US, but compared to, say, Italy, it doesn't even register, really. 29 projects in build currently. That's interesting.
Yeah, it is. And it's also a bit surprising because historically we've always thought that US buyers like to buy US boats. And these numbers suggest that perhaps they're buying Italian boats or German boats or whatever. So that's another thing to consider. It also seems that semi-custom rather than custom is the end of the US market that is doing the best. That's borne out by the three top American yards, which are all semi-custom builders. We've got Westport, which is preparing two models for 2022, the 117 and their new flagship, the 172. Viking, which remains the leader in the sportfish niche and is delivering its 21st hull in the Viking 92 series. And finally, Hatteras, which has just delivered its first hull in the 105-foot series with hull 2 scheduled for the end of the year.
And I think that's important to note, isn't it? Look, despite the numbers not necessarily going in the right direction from a manufacturing point of view, there are some outstanding US builders still doing some really good things. I mean, Westport is just a phenomenon. And we wrote a feature for the Virtual Boat Show recently about how the Westport 112 was, in our view, probably the most successful super yacht in history. They just cannot sell enough of those boats. It's amazing. And it's just a charter machine, the Westport 112. And they've got some great plans. Viking build stunning sportfish boats. Absolutely understandable that they're doing well. And there's other brands like Hatteras as well. The trend's not going in the right direction, but I suppose if you are looking for a bright spot, that is that there are still some really, really quality builders, and not forgetting Delta Marine as well up in Seattle, who build just stunning boats as well. So, you know, it's not all bad news. Alrighty, that's all the news and data for this week. Stay tuned for my interview with Ben Willows, the CEO of the UKSA. So Ben, thanks so much for joining us for our boat briefing podcast interview. For the purposes of everyone listening, can you just tell us a bit about what the UKSA is?
Sure, yeah. Well, first of all, Stuart, thank you for having me. Look, UKSA is a maritime charity. We were founded nearly 35 years ago, so 35 will be 35 next year. And we were founded by an entrepreneur called Noel Lister, who was the guy who set up MFI, the massive furniture company. And he and his wife, Sylvia, Noel passed away a few years ago, but Sylvia's still very much with us. They were avid sailors, and they had 12 yachts actually over their sort of lifetime and sailing careers, and ended up with a big Royal Huisman built beautiful yacht.
Sloop. That's right, yeah, they're well-known shipyard owners, weren't they?
Yeah, they were, yeah, Whirlwind 12 was the last one. And anyway, they did two fantastic circumnavigations around the world, and Noel, you know, once he'd sold MFI, made quite a reasonable amount of money, wanted to put something back. And at the time, the place where I'm sat at now in Cowes used to be the National Sailing Centre. It was being closed. And Noel and Sylvia very generously bought the facility and turned and founded the charity UKSA, UK Sailing Academy. And 35 years later, we're here, and we're now the world's largest ROA training centre. We're one of the largest providers of professional MCA yacht qualifications anywhere in the world. And we are the only charity anywhere or training organisation that takes a six-year-old for their first experience on the water. And that could be on a paddleboard, a kayak, in a dinghy, right the way through to training young people to become professional water sports instructors, ROA yacht master skippers, right the way through to Officer to Watch 3000 and Masters tickets. So a huge range. And, you know, fundamentally, what we do is we provide access and opportunities to get on the water and have an amazing adventure if you're a young person or a child, especially for those children that wouldn't otherwise get the opportunity to do it. So we're specifically focused on, you know, inner city schools or children in schools from areas of deprivation around the UK, right the way through to full-time education courses, vocational training and professional maritime qualifications, all with the focus of getting into employment. So we're not, we're not a charity that goes, oh, just come and have a great time on the water. Yeah. We're very much about education and training and getting people into jobs. And it's all about maritime for us, you know. It's all about getting people into this sector.
The breadth of what you do is incredible. Like you said, you know, just getting kids from cities into dinghies from a very early age, right up to Officer of the Watch 3000. Gross tons, you know, so that is the gap.
Yeah, there is nowhere else in the world that does what we do across that spectrum of activity. And, you know, I think the thing, as I said a moment ago, that makes us quite unique and makes us brilliant at what we do, it's all about actually, you know, getting people inspired about, one, being on the water and being in this sector, but about going and getting an outcome, passing a qualification that gets a young person into a further college or a university and or going into employment. That's what it's all about.
And you're kind of at the coalface, really. So are more people getting inspired to get on the water? You know, are you seeing a growth in interest from young people about getting into the maritime sector?
For sure, we are. You know, I think the demand for our programs has probably never been so high. Yeah, I think the but is that we would like to, you know, a major part of mine and this organisation's strategies is to widen access. Okay, and what we mean by that is to reach out and put in front of young people that would never even dream of being able to access maritime employment or going to super yachting, these opportunities. Because I think, you know, one of the great things we've done with Edmiston, which you might want to talk about in a little while, is, you know, we recognise that, you know, there isn't a huge amount of diversity coming through into this type of sector. And although demand is high, there's more young people coming through, what we're not seeing is demand from, you know, there's harder to reach areas of the country, from disadvantaged people from backgrounds. So I think one of our major pieces of work as a strategy is to work with those groups, work with those cohorts of young people, and actually show them there's a fantastic training pathway and career opportunities over here, and get it in front of them so that there's a way in which they can engage and there's a pathway for them. And you know, one of our big things is around making sure that there is funding and engagement pathways to make people sure they're ready to go on to this sector. Because you know, it's not for everybody, as we know, it's absolutely not for everyone. And people's expectations have got to be set and make sure they're ready to go into this sector. And that's one of the big things that we do, is make sure that you know, people are prepared as possible.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a great mission because, as we're all aware, I mean, the super yachting industry and probably the maritime sector generally isn't the most ethnically diverse community of people. So the fact that you're making this sector now available to communities that wouldn't traditionally ever have thought about a career in maritime is a great thing to do.
Yeah, that's right. And we've launched what we call this Sea Change Fund. And within that is... You know, so if we start from the beginning, we work with about 8,500 to 9,000 school children each year. Well, not last year because of COVID, but we'll come back to that. But normally we'd be doing 8,500 to 9,000 school children. And we specifically target and work with big multi-academy trusts that have lots of schools in really hard to reach areas of the country, you know, areas of high deprivation, big, you know, ethnic diverse backgrounds. And we get them here for their first ever trip away from home. It could be the first time they've left the 3 miles postcode in which they've grown up in. And actually getting on a coach and coming down from Liverpool or Manchester or Cardiff and actually coming across to Solent for these kids is a major, major thing for them, you know. And then they come and spend a few days here, a five-day residential trip with us, actually first time ever going on the water. And that's great. That's an amazing, hopeful experience that they'll cherish and have forever. But what we've now done is we've put in place what we call the Sea Change Fund, which those young people in the schools, can they help us identify here? Those young children that go, do you know, I love this. We then have these structured programs in the school holidays for them, all funded, where they can come back, spend a bit more time with us and get a really good sight of what the opportunities are in the maritime sector. So that will be introducing them to the opportunities in super yachting. It could be water sports instructing. So that then they, you know, they have another five full days with us in the school holidays where they really get a feel for it. And if then they go, do you know what, I'd really like to do this when I'm a bit older, we can provide them with opportunities to apply for bursaries to go on to the career training. And, you know, train them as a deckhand, train them as an interior crew, train them as a skipper. And that's the way to do it. Because I think if you don't start with children right at a young age with their first experience, you don't get the maritime opportunities in front of them.
Yeah, and you mentioned there a lot of that is fully funded. So obviously there's the paid for courses. That's the element for obviously adults who want to get into the industry. You can pay for the
course.
But the school funding. So how is your funding mixed?
Well, it's you know, I think one of the beauties of us is, you know, we're not just a charity that relies solely on just donations and people coming in to give us money to do the great works that we do. We've got a really smart mix of, as you rightly say, paid for, you know, commercial courses where, you know, you're getting the highest degree and level of professional delivery, professional qualifications. And, you know, people pay for that or their employers pay for it. That's happening more frequently now. And then we also have bursary funding where we can supply funding to young people that just don't have access to that type of funding to come and do the courses. We also have what we call sort of schools and youth engagement funding as well, so we can pay for schools to come. Or, you know, quite often, Stuart, what you see is the school wants to bring 50 children, for example, but 10 of them, their parents just simply can't afford for them to come, and they would normally just be left behind the school. And we will provide some funding assistance for those 10 children to make sure that the whole cohort can come. So all those types of support funds for young people come from a whole variety. They come from individual donors, they come from trusts and foundations, they come from some commercial sponsorship. And what we're doing is we're trying to encourage our supporters and network to put money and funds into what we call the Sea Change Fund, and we can disperse that to schools, to individual young people that want to come and train for a professional qualification, and use it across those sort of two key pillars of our work, across schools and professional training.
And was that part of the Lister's original vision for the UKSA? They just wanted to kind of open this world to more and more people.
Absolutely. It was always about getting these opportunities to young people that wouldn't otherwise have the opportunity. But at the same time, for those people that have been fortunate enough to grow up with sailing or grow up in water sports or yachting or whatever it may be, there's a centre of excellence here where they can come and get the very best maritime training and education that enables them to continue on their hope, you know, their love of being on the water and go work in this sector. So yeah, it very, very much was founded on those two principles, really.
And we should add at this point for our American listeners that MFI was a very successful furniture manufacturer. That's right.
It was, I think at this time it was being sold, it was one of, if not the, it was certainly one of the biggest companies in Europe.
Yeah.
You know, so he was a very smart guy. He was the guy that went, you know, let's not take up big warehouses with furniture pre-built. We'll sell it to the customer flat pat and they can take it home and build it, which is basically what modern IKEA is, right? It's exactly that concept.
That's right. I remember MFI. Yeah. So, Ben, what about you personally? So are you an Islander? Are you from the Isle of Wight? How did you get involved with the UKSA?
Sure. So, no, not from the island. I live here now. Love the place. This is our home. Sort of been permanently based here now since sort of 2007-08. Absolutely, it's a wonderful place to be. Very fortunate to be here, actually. But no, originally I grew up in Northampton in the Midlands, which is about as far from the sea in the UK as you can get. But look, my dad was a really keen dinghy sailor. And there's some great reservoirs, Northampton Sailing Club, at Pittsford Water, Rutland, Grafham, you know, people that know the Midlands well and sail will know those pieces of water. There's some great reservoirs around there. So I was fortunate that my dad encouraged me and I was able to get into dinghy sailing. No big boating at all, just always dinghy racing. And then, you know, I fell in love with it really and was fortunate enough to get involved in the British sailing team through the youth squads, etc. One of my first sort of engagements with UKSA was to come down here when I was probably, 17 or 18 to do things like my professional instructor training and things like that. You know, fell in love with the place. I then went off to Australia for quite a long time to continue on doing sort of professional racing and was fortunate enough to do some skiff sailing and things like that out there. And always pursued very, very, you know, pretty high level and competitive dinghy sailing. And then I was really fortunate enough to actually land a job here teaching and running all of UKSA's professional instructor training. So that was dinghy sailing and windsurfing and all of the sort of paddle sports and things like that. And then went back out to Australia because UKSA ran an overseas centre out there for a period. And my now wife and I back then went out and ran that centre for UKSA for a few years, which is just, actually, quite frankly, it was probably the best job ever for me, for being a water sports fanatic and being able to teach and run these professional training courses for young people in Oz was just brilliant. But then for lots of different reasons, UKSA, we closed that centre in Australia, and then actually I came back here and took an overall sort of operations management job here, looking after all the operations for UKSA, and sort of worked my way up to be appointed chief executive in 2016. So sort of 5 years now of overview and leading the organisation. So yeah, absolute privilege. You know, I love the place, and it's been a huge part of my life. I don't know, there's many places where you get to walk down the driveway into work and you just see, you've got the water base out in front of you. I'm just looking out the window. You've got children on the water. You've got professional training going on a big boat. It's a pretty magical place to be involved with, actually.
Well, it's synonymous with sailing, isn't it? Cows in the Isle of Wight, and sailors all over the world will know of it and appreciate its importance and to the sector globally, I think.
Yeah,
and the America's Cup might be coming.
Yeah, so the rumor mill is high on that one. And wouldn't that be great? You know, I think it would be that would be a real bit of kudos for Cowes in the UK to get to get Ben and his team to challenge for the cup here on home waters. That would be amazing, absolutely amazing. So, yeah, fingers crossed they managed to get that one over the line.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll keep tabs on that. So. You've been in the big chair for 5 years, and what is your mission? What is your kind of central principle for the UKSA? Where do you want to leave it when you eventually leave the CEO job? Where do you want the UKSA to be?
So I guess a few things, Stuart. One is when I took over, you know, UKSA was running some high quality, fantastic programs, but for lots of different reasons. The site and the facilities and the infrastructure being underinvested in. So one of the things I wanted to make sure was that, you know, from my tenure as CEO, UKSA has the very best teaching facilities, world-class teaching facilities, and an environment where every student can achieve their best, whatever that may be. And so I set off on, we spent a year or so putting that plan together. And in end of 2017, we launched a capital development plan that would see UKSA significantly invest in a new yacht fleet. We invested in taking on a new training centre. So there's a big new training centre directly situated just to the north on our boundary that we've taken on. We've implemented brand new training navigational facilities. We've developed a super yacht galley for training interior crew. It is a brilliant facility. We have taken on a whole new yacht fleet. And most excitingly, during that period, we have raised over £4 million to demolish a significant part of our site, including one of the big accommodation centres, which has happened now. So that's all been demolished. And we're building a brand new reception and state-of-the-art accommodation facility on the site, which should be open in April next year. Okay. And I really wanted to make sure that but by doing that, we significantly increased our capacity. So, you know, we were an organisation that was delivering around 8,500 total students a year. Before COVID, we'd got that to 10,000. And by the time this infrastructure development and plan is finished, we will be delivering over 14,000 students a year. So I really wanted to significantly increase the organisation's capacity and make sure that we had world-class facilities. So this, you know, UKSA can go on and be successful for another 35 years and have facilities that would stand the test of time and, you know, be an organisation that students would look at, physically look at and see online and go, gosh, I'd love to go and train there. Yeah. And be somewhere that's really inspiring and aspirational for students to come to.
And for employers too, for owners and captains, when they're, you know, sifting CVs, you want them to see UKSA and think this is a person who's...
Yeah, yeah. And you know, as I said, you know, UKSA was delivering fantastic training. But, you know, from employers' perspective, owners of yachts, as you say, you know, if they were to come to the site or see us online, they'd see a pretty tired organisation in terms of the way it looked and felt, in terms of its facilities. And, you know, if we are, you know, UKSA absolutely has to stand the test of time. And it is training captains and officers and young people to go and work on deck on, you know, some of the largest super yachts and best super yachts in the world. The organisation needs to match that. And so that's very much been the mission. The other stage that's underpinning that has been a huge outreach strategy in identifying and working with the big multi-academy trust groups in the country. That, as I said earlier, that, you know, we'll have, you know, EACT is a great example for it. EACT have about 17 primary schools all around the country in some of the hardest areas of the UK. And we've done a relationship with them where they bring every single one of their primary schools at year five across our season. And, you know, that is giving the best of UKSA in terms of our opportunities to these young children that wouldn't otherwise get the opportunity to do it. So, you know, outreach and making sure these pathways and opportunity and funding is in place to attract people to us and, yeah, having a site and facilities that, you know, will stand the test of time and make us a really aspirational place to come to.
And I remember we spoke once about the real world outcomes of these programs on kids' attainment in school. And there's a measurable improvement in output, isn't there, in attainment levels, like giving them access to the facilities you have down there in Cowes and just the water generally and sailing?
Yeah, I mean, there's loads of studies done on this stuff. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to work out that actually, you know, outdoor positive adventures, I would argue, and, you know, the data sort of backs this up, that actually being on the water is probably one of the most empowering environments that there is. And, you know, getting young people out of the classroom, out of what can be pretty difficult home environments, and giving them an opportunity to have an adventure, be put in a completely different environment, spend time with their friends, build stronger relationships, build resilience, teamwork. they are really, really important things for children's development. And gosh, that has been so sorely missed due to this COVID pandemic. And I think it's needed more now than ever before. And I was just over the moon last Friday when the Department of Education finally announced that residential school trips can happen again this summer. There are some caveats to that and some COVID guidance to go along with it. But, you know, as I said earlier, normally you'd have, 8,000, 8,500 children coming through here each year. We didn't have hardly any last year. I think we had in the low hundreds. So, you know, to be able to start re-engaging the schools again and get trips happening, it's just fantastic. And we do these skills for life assessments, Stuart. So each time children come through, they sort of assess themselves on some criteria before the trip and after. And we see a significant uplift in students' attainment, teamwork, resilience, self-confidence. Sometimes, you know, teachers will say students' attendance just goes up. So they're spending more time at school. You know, they're phenomenal things. And, you know, what we want to do, as I said earlier, is make sure that there's an opportunity for those young people to come back and have some professional education and training and a career in this area if they want to.
So you mentioned the dreaded C word. Let's tackle that. So the last year has obviously been incredibly challenging. And as an organisation that kind of relies on having people, bums on seats as it is, as it were, in the classroom. So how have you adapted to that?
Yeah, that's true. It's been, I don't underuse this word. It's been really tough. It's been brutal at points, actually. You know, never to be so out of our, the last year, we were effectively closed for six of the last 12 months, effectively. Really, really difficult. We were able to adapt and do some what we call online live learning, especially for the sort of super yachting, off sort of watch type style training. But even that is, it's, although we were able to switch that on, we worked with the MCA really closely and had great support through that process. We managed to switch that on quite quickly. In relative terms, that amount of income and activity overall was relatively small in terms of what we'd lost. We had a significant proportion of our staff, probably 85 to 90% at one point for quite a long period on the furlough scheme. There was no other way to do it. We also had to go through quite a difficult restructuring process to make sure the organisation was shaped and fit for purpose for reopening under what was a completely different operating model with significantly lower incomes and student volumes to begin with. Because one of the big things which we're now limited on, goes to no surprise, is the amount of students we can physically have on the site and in things like bedrooms and in classrooms due to social distancing. So, you know, that's had a pretty material effect. As we start now going forward, we expect that to improve and get better. But certainly, as we went through last year, I mentioned earlier, we didn't have any school groups at all. So, you know, that side of the organisation and the our activities was completely gone. But we did open in sort of August, and then in September time, as schools reopened, we were able to restart our full-time education courses, our professional training, career-style courses, and we're still doing that now as we speak. And that reopened about 3 weeks ago. So that was fantastic for us. But we ran all the way through till Christmas and New Year before the government announced the sort of second or third big lockdown. It's been hard. It's been hard. But we have reshaped, and we've got ourselves really well set up now to run under these COVID restrictions, reduced capacity. The way in which the organisation has responded, the commitment from the staff has been phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. There's been other organisations that run sort of outdoor activities that haven't been able to get through. And there was certainly a time, certainly last year, you know, we were thinking, crikey, how are we going to do this? But, you know, we've got some fantastic support through some of our donors. And a huge credit and thank you to them. We thought very carefully about how we would use our funding and our reserves to best support the charity through that interruption where we were closed down. And they're things, you know, it was the same for all businesses, wasn't it? They are things that you just, there's no way you could plan for that. You know, that had never happened in anyone's lifetime, really. Total business closure, shut down for that period of time. Everyone was into brand new territory and thinking very hard about how we were going to get through it. So, out of all the things I think we've achieved at UKSA in the last sort of 4 to 5 years, certainly of my time in charge here and being the CEO, I think getting through last year and being able to open so successfully with a really thriving organisation with a demand really high for courses and students back here and engaged. And I think that's probably the thing I'm most proud about, actually. And huge credit to, as I say, to the organisation, the board of trustees, to respond the way we did. And we had to make some really tough decisions, as lots of organisations did. But, I think if we hadn't, it could have been a very different outcome. We're probably operating 35 to 40% of what we should be. But we've managed to adjust and get the organisation to be able to do that. And we've still got some staff on furlough. And we hope that as the lockdown, let's fingers crossed, continue to ease and we work through these next gates, 12th of April, 17th of May, we're looking at these dates really carefully. We can start introducing more of our courses and more volumes onto the site and let's just fingers crossed we don't get any more road bumps along the way, especially big ones. I don't think any of us expect, given what's happened in the last 12 months, this just to be plain sailing from this point. COVID's going to be with us for a very long time, if not forever. And we've all got to adapt and live life slightly differently, I think. But the way in which the vaccine rollout appears to be going in this country, that certainly gives me a lot of hope for the future that we can get back to some form of normality. And I think we're all craving for it. Certainly for me, being able to reopen again sort of 3 weeks ago, just seeing staff back on the site, seeing students again, it was like coming out from under a dark cloud. It really was. And I think everyone's felt like that. So, good for everyone's well-being, good for everyone's sort of mental health to be sort of back doing things again. And so fingers crossed, Stuart, it just continues to be that way, right?
Absolutely. So you mentioned kind of 35 to 40% now. In, say, yep. Cast your mind forward to the height of the summer. Do you hope to be somewhere near 100%, or is that a dream at the moment?
Still feels a bit of a dream, if I'm honest. I think hopefully by the way, what we're planning at this stage is by September, when we get effectively another big intake of professional courses and people training over the UK winter for the start of the following season, we really hope those courses will be back to full capacity.
Okay.
The big unknown is quite what capacity we get or sort of influx we get in terms of schools and groups visitors. As I said earlier, the government has said that can happen again from May, but there's so many caveats to it. And, the big thing with schools and groups is it's not something you can switch on really easily. These trips take a lot of time and planning for the schools. Some schools will be able to do it quite quickly, and I hope we'll be able to come either over our summer or into the autumn. But others may just not. They're under huge resource constraints. They're having to play catch up for all of the curriculum that kids have missed. So it's difficult. It's a big juggle for the schools. We'll do everything we can to make it as easy for them as possible. But, certainly from the professional training side and our education courses, we're expecting from September to be almost back to full strength. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's great to hear. And just tell us about, you've recently teamed up with Edmiston as well. So yeah. How do they fit into things?
Yeah, so we've it's been fantastic what Jamie and the team at Edmiston have done there. I've been talking to Alex Holden at Edmiston and the team with Jamie for quite some time about ways in which we could work together. And I think, great credit to Edmiston. They have been really keen to support us. And actually, it was due to we were coming into halfway through the first main COVID lockdown. And I think that point in time made everyone have a bit of a rethink. And there was a lot of time for reflection and thinking, what could we do differently to help going forwards? And, Edmiston very much did that. And they approached me and said, look, we would like to put something together with you. What do you think would be most appropriate? And what we did is I just went back to them with our strategy that I talked a little bit about earlier, about what we've got to do. If you're really keen to support greater diversity coming into super yachting, you've got to start with children, with them at schools. So let's start there. And then we'll have this middle section with the Sea Change Fund where we can get them back in their school holidays and show them all about the maritime sector and the opportunities in super yachting. And then we'll put some professional training on for them when they're that bit older and get them employed into the super yacht sector. So we formed the Edmiston Foundation. It's working across those three pillars. So Edmiston are very, very generously supplying funding to support about 200 school children coming on school trips. Fantastic. We've got funding for about 50 young people to come on the Sea Change Foundation. So that will be in school holidays. And then we've got funding for 12 to 16 professional deck crew training courses, where we'll be training them to become professional deck crew over a 6 to 8 week period, and then getting them employed in the superyacht sector. And what this is all about, Stuart, is actually going out, as I said earlier, reaching out to ethnic minorities, specifically young people from the BAME communities, if we can, and also just young people who are from, you know, difficult and disadvantaged backgrounds, and giving them a real, you know, opportunity to have a pathway, a structured pathway, with funding in place from Edmiston and through UKSA's expertise, and try and get some of these young people employed in the superyacht sector. And what we've said is we're going to do sort of 2021. It's so COVID interrupted at the minute, but we'll do this as a bit of a pilot. There'll be some lessons to be learned. And then hopefully, you know, we can get this rolling. What I've said to Edmiston, you know, if it all starts to come together, we should see this as a long-term project over sort of 5 years plus, because, you know, it takes time to build these relationships and get these introductions and opportunities into these communities. It doesn't just happen overnight. It takes a long time. You've got to get some case studies where you can show back to these communities and families, look what this young person's gone on and achieved with UKSA's evidence and support. You could do that. And I'm huge excited about it. And I think hopefully it will demonstrate to the rest of the, you know, superyacht family that, you know, us as a professional training organisation, Edmiston as a really big organisation, an employer, yacht management and broker company, are trying to make a big difference in broadening diversity and opportunities for entry into the maritime, sorry, the superyacht sector.
That's enormously exciting, and good on Edmiston and you guys.
Fabulous for them to do it. I mean, full credit to Jamie and Nick and the team there. I mean, they've really, fantastic. And I know they want to try and work with their network to see if their network can also help with funding as well. And I think, you know, they've obviously got access to, and hopefully can use their relationships within the sector to make this not just a one-off and make it a long-term sustainable project.
And if any other owners might be listening to this, or any other people in the superyacht sector want to get involved and help out in your mission to get more young people on the water, how would they do that exactly? There are opportunities, presumably, to work with.
Absolutely. We've got a ready-made project specifically for the superyacht sector through the Edmiston Foundation. So you could absolutely come and join and be part of that. And more widely, we've created the Sea Change Fund, as I said before, which is about supporting almost exactly what Edmiston are doing, is supporting the key pillars of UKSA's work, and reaching out to children and young people that wouldn't otherwise get the opportunity to train in this sector. And the best way to do that is just contact me directly. Drop me an email through... I'd love to, you know, one of the things we want to do, we work with hundreds of employers in the superyacht sector, come and talk to us and recruit our students. And we would love more than to be more widely engaged and involved about our mission to widen access and get more young people coming through our training schemes and into employment.
Well, it's a fantastic initiative, and it'd be great to see more people getting involved, certainly in the Sea Change side of things. Mission.
Thank you, Stuart.
Well, Ben, really appreciate your time. Thank you very much. Good luck with everything, and we'll catch up again soon.
Yeah, lovely to talk, and thanks for having me on.
Pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Ed Cavendish and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week.